There is no single story coming out of Copenhagen, the climate talks in December 2009. There are hundreds. Today we'll cover the struggle of just two continents, North America, the great wealthy polluter, and Africa, the poorest victim of global climate change. We'll do it as only radio can. On a shoestring, a band of radio activists found the voices we never hear in mainstream media. They broadcast it daily to London, to Resonance FM. You'll hear Phil England and Frederica Whitehead, plus audio from 350.org. More importantly, you'll get firsthand the voices of the dispossessed, the representatives of Africa. In spite of my years of studying climate change, my many interviews with top climate scientists, I never understood until now the real impact of climate disruption on Africa. Where hundreds of millions depend upon simple rain-fed agriculture, the rains are not coming or flood out everything when they do. Lake Chad, Africa's largest lake, has almost disappeared, drying out into a few marshes. It's hard to imagine. Even farming-rich South Africa is drying out, with worse to come in the next decades. We all need to wake up and listen to the distress calls from Africa. Meanwhile, the oil empire of America is trying to decide what to do. Does America have to gut the Clean Air Act to make new climate legislation? Here is Phil England of Climate Radio with Cassie Siegel.
Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Copenhagen Daily is a networked experiment amongst a number of people, both here in Copenhagen and in London.
So I'm here with Cassie Siegel from the Centre for Biological Diversity in the US.
Co-author of a new report, Yes He Can.
That's right. And the report, it's called Yes He Can, President Obama's Power to Make an International Climate Commitment Without Waiting for Congress.
Okay. First, I thought we'd look at what Obama is currently said he would bring to Copenhagen, just to put everything in context for people and how that matches up and whether it's good enough. But what has he currently said he would do?
What the president has proposed is for the U.S. To put a politically binding deal on the table to cut emissions about 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. That translates into only about 3% below 1990 levels. And this proposal is completely inadequate because it's completely out of line with what the science says we need to do. The science says we need to get carbon dioxide back to below 350 parts per million. That means reductions of 45% or more from the U.S. and other industrialized countries.
And that's without using offsets as well?
Well, that's without using offsets because offsets generally don't get you real reductions. And we need real reductions of 45% or more below 1990 levels. And, you know, that is to avoid absolute climate chaos. I mean, the climate scientists have their hair on fire about this stuff. I mean, we're already seeing massive impacts. 300,000 people per year already die because of global warming. We're destroying entire ecosystems. Polar bears, a species that I work on, they're drowning, starving, and even resorting to cannibalism just from the rapid climate change we're already seeing. We're approaching or have already passed tipping points. And the 3% below 1990 levels that's on the table will lead to catastrophe. It's not something we can go forward with.
So is Obama coming forward with the 3% because that is what the House of Representatives have currently passed? And if so, I understand that actually that form of legislation, if that were to go right through Congress, you had a graph the other night that showed a Breakthrough Institute analysis that with offsets, actually there might be an increase in carbon emissions under that kind of cap-and-trade style legislation. So what's going on?
Well, that's right. The president's proposal mirrors the reductions that are in the climate bill that passed the House of Representatives this summer. And while the bill says that it aims to reduce emissions 3% below 1990 levels by 2020, actual U.S. emissions could continue to go up all the way through 2026. The reason that is because the bill contains 2 billion tons of offsets. And to give you a sense of scale, the total emissions of the U.S. economy is about 7 billion tons per year. So with 2 billion tons of offsets in the bill, you could have actual emissions continue to go up all the way through 2026. So polluters would continue to pollute. They would just theoretically be paying someone somewhere else to say that they're sequestering carbon or reducing carbon or what have you. But if you have actual emissions go up through 2026, we're talking about climate catastrophe. We can't allow that to happen.
Now, there's been a new development, I understand, this week with Lisa Jackson, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, making an announcement about an intention to go ahead and use the existing authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate things like coal-fired power plants. Is that in order to back up this 3% pledge, or is there something else going on?
Well, it's actually separate, and that's one of the things we address in our report. It's often stated that the president can't commit to a deal here until Congress acts, or that we can't start reducing our emissions in the U.S. and commit to numeric targets until we get a new climate bill. That's actually not true, because we already have a law called the Clean Air Act. It is one of the world's most successful environmental laws, and it already provides a comprehensive system for the reduction of greenhouse pollution. The Bush administration refused to implement the Clean Air Act for greenhouse gases. The Supreme Court said that was illegal. And now the Obama administration is going forward with pollution reductions under the Clean Air Act as a result of that Supreme Court decision. And so it is really a fallacy to say that the president's hands are tied because Congress hasn't acted. The president can commit to science-based, deep and rapid emissions reductions here in Copenhagen, and he can achieve them through the Clean Air Act. He just needs to fully implement the law. What most people don't know, though, is that the climate bills under consideration in Congress would actually gut the Clean Air Act, and they would prevent the EPA from using this existing law, which is much stronger than the new climate bill, from actually solving the problem.
Now, some people have been saying that the Obama administration has been using the threat of EPA authority as a kind of bargaining chip in order to get a kind of cap-and-trade bill through. So it's like saying to industry, if you don't accept this actually industry-friendly legislation, then we'll kind of clobber you with some proper regulation. But does the Lisa Jackson announcement mean that it's no longer a bargaining chip, but they're actually going to go ahead and use it regardless?
Well, we certainly hope so, and we and others have been working on this intensely. Lisa Jackson said something really good the other day. She said this isn't an either-or situation, and that's what we've been saying all year. It is a ridiculous way to frame the issue, to say that you have to have climate legislation or the Clean Air Act. There's absolutely no reason for that. The Clean Air Act is the strongest tool, the best tool for reducing greenhouse pollution. It's also completely compatible with any other tool that Congress might want to put in place. So, for example, when Congress put in a cap-and-trade system for acid rain in 1990, they did that. They didn't take away any of the Clean Air Act's programs. They left that safety net in place for the acid rain pollutants, for sulfur dioxide and oxides of nitrogen. This notion that we're going to trade the Clean Air Act for a new cap-and-trade bill is an absolute travesty. We must not do that. We have to keep the safety net of the Clean Air Act, whatever else Congress chooses to do.
Okay. Realistically, what do you think Obama is going to do at the end of next week? I know you've been petitioning, along with 350.org, the Obama administration, or perhaps the Environmental Protection Agency directly, in order to use their existing authority to do something which is consistent with the science. I don't know, are the wheels turning fast enough for that to happen? Or is this meeting going to end in crisis that everyone expects?
Right. Well, it's a long shot at this point for a good outcome here, a very, very long shot. You have to be an optimist to believe that the future is uncertain when you work in climate change, unfortunately. But one of the things we're trying to do with our report is we're trying to get the word out there that these assumptions that the president's hands are tied by Congress or that we can't act until we have a new climate bill are false. And when the administration says that 3% below 1990 is the best they can do because we don't have a climate bill, that's absolutely incorrect. The president has all the legal tools he needs to cut a deal here. When the administration has the political will to get something done, you do not hear them complaining about Congress blocking it. They get it done. And we want everybody to know that it is not a legal constraint on the president if he doesn't put a better deal here on the table. It is a political choice. And I'm not trying to downplay the difficulty of the political situation in the U.S. We have enormous challenges. We have misinformation and confusion about climate science rampant. We have endless debates. But the president ran on a promise of change and a promise to take action on climate change. And it will be an enormous act of moral and political courage to do so. But that's what the science demands, and that's what we're asking him to do. The science says we must, the law says we can, and we need everyone to ask, demand of President Obama that he say, yes, we will.
Incredibly, in oil-dependent Nigeria, there has been a major conference calling for a halt to further exploration, leave it in the soil, to develop a real economy, and to save the climate of Africa. Here is Phil England of Climate Radio with Nimo Bassi, head of Friends of Earth, Nigeria.
And who is involved with this? I understand it's quite a high level. Is it the Environment Ministry? Pretty much the whole of Nigerian civil society?
Yes, we had, at the end of the day, the resolutions of the conference was endorsed by 117 organizations, and the conference was supported by the Federal Ministry of Environment and the UNDP, as well as Friends of the Earth, Netherlands, and Oxfam Novib. The outcomes are not driven by those who supported the conference, but the civil society groups who were there, 117, fully endorsed what we did and what the outcome was. And you see, by leaving you all in the soil, you are stopping the release of carbon as source. It's a major move to help check global warming. And we're saying that not only could oil should be left in the soil, we should also not look for any other form of dirty energy. Leave the coal in the hole. Don't look for the tar sand, because this brings even worse environmental consequences.
It seems to represent a gear change or a paradigm shift almost in civil society's view on this, because up until recently it was much more about limiting local pollution, oil spills, local environmental damage, maybe getting a bit more tax revenues for development in the Niger Delta, things like that. But this is now a different demand. It's about saying that actually this stuff is probably not so good for us after all.
Yeah, what we're doing is a major political and environmental demand. We want to be a real shift in the political thinking, and we want the Nigerian economy to be re-engineered, kick back to start, come back alive. The economy has been dead. People are living outside the formal economy. People are just surviving on their own. So, and there's been a complete disconnect between public revenue and people's prosperity. And we're saying when you leave new oil in the soil and recover a lot of oil from oil theft, now whatever shortfall, people would contribute by paying for barrels of oil when you live in the soil. You know, people are poor, they cannot pay, but they would try. There are people indicating that if they have a responsible government and system that would manage the economy properly, they are ready to make sacrifices. People want to say, yes, this is our money in the national purse. It's our money that's being spent. Spend our money right. Be accountable, be transparent. But, you know, when people just stay back and then oil revenues flood the national coffers and you have huge budgets and then nothing impacts the people. Since oil economy is almost like a fiction, I mean, it's like voodoo economics. People are so disconnected from the resources, and a lot of decision makers don't even see the pollution. So there's no question. So we want to restore a connection between governance and those who are governed.
But African representatives at Copenhagen were aggrieved and angry to discover their Danish hosts colluded with the biggest countries to write a kind of polluters' treaty behind their backs called the Danish Text. Here is a clip from the spontaneous protest that broke out in the main conference hall.
There should be nothing more than 1 degree, because 2 degrees spells suicide for Africa. We are suffering enough. Africa should not be divided again.
Sure.
We will not die in silence. Africa has been silent for too long, and you must listen to us. We are not asking for any aid. We are not begging.
One Africa.
1 degree.
One position.
1 degree.
One Africa.
1 degree.
The recording you have just heard was provided by 350.org, who were present during the action. One of the key problems for Africa is the 2 degree global cap. A global warming, an average global warming of 2 degrees, would mean that, in fact, temperatures in Africa would rise by 3.5 degrees. This, in effect, would make large parts of Africa uninhabitable. The target of attempting to limit global temperatures to a 2 degree rise is now 13 years old, and scientists are now telling us that serious damage will happen well before a 2 degree rise in average temperatures. And many people are arguing for the upper threshold to be reduced to a 1.5 degree rise or even a 1 degree temperature rise. In the recording, you heard the impromptu demonstration led by Lumumba Diaping, one of the Sudanese negotiators here in Copenhagen. Diaping was reacting furiously at the news that broke of a leaked document now known as the Danish Accord. You heard him leading the chart: no political deal, bad deal, nothing more than 1 degree, 1 degree, one Africa, one position. He's reacting against a divide and rule strategy that was revealed by the leaking of the Danish Accord. This was leaked to The Guardian, and you can read the full text on the website. Basically, the Danish Accord was a pre-prepared document which completely goes against the spirit of negotiations, something that was pre-prepared and given to weaker, smaller countries to sign with some financial incentives.
Frederica Whitehead reporting for Resonance FM, London. And it all links back to the United States, historically the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. We'll wrap up with a passionate letter to Obama, written by the African delegates. Here is Phil England.
On the day that President Obama picked up his Nobel Peace Prize, which was awarded partly due to his re-engagement on climate change internationally, the massive civil society organization, the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, sent a letter to President Obama, pleading with him to fulfill the promise of his inauguration speech and to not betray his brothers and sisters in Africa. PACTCHA delegate Sylvia Wachira was kind enough to read it for us.
My name is Sylvia Wachira from the Pan-Africa Climate Justice Alliance. Dear Mr. President, we write to you with great pride and respect to your leadership. You are known throughout our continent as the son of Africa. We are your brothers and sisters from Africa. We represent an alliance of civil society organizations in 43 countries across Africa that brings together a diverse group of people who share a common concern for our continent and the growing catastrophe of climate change. In your inaugural address to the presidency of the world's most powerful nation, you affirmed your commitment to help the world's poor by saying, I quote, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds, and to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect." End of quote. We take these pledges seriously, and we intend to hold you to your word. Our rivers are drying, our crops are turning to dust, and unrelenting sun scorches our land, while other areas are ravaged by storms and diseases. Scientists now say the world could warm by 6 degrees Celsius and by more in Africa. This threatens nothing less than the collapse of our continent. Today, Africa grapples with a challenge that is not of our making. impacts we had little role in causing. We find no alternative but to look to those nations that contribute most to causing climate change and to call on them to lead by example. As the world's largest contributor to greenhouse gas concentrations and as the world's wealthiest nation, the United States has a singular duty to ensure that Africa is kept safe from rising impacts of climate change. Yet, we find it failing in this duty, along with other leaders of developed nations you have proposed. One, that global average temperatures be limited to below 2 degrees Celsius. Yet, this threatens catastrophic harm to Africa, which will likely warm by around 1.5 times this global average. The global emissions be limited to 50% of 1990 levels by 2050. Yet this risks a 50% chance of exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. And third, that Annex 1 countries cut their emissions by 80% by 2050, which would rob Africa of its fair share of atmospheric space and limit our prospects of development while we grapple with a more hostile climate. You are coming to Europe to receive a Nobel Prize in Oslo and to attend the UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. You must live up to the dignity of the Nobel Prize when you come to Copenhagen. You must listen to the voice of other countries, including Africa. Our greatest single concern is that the United States seems to be seeking to continue domestic pollution well into the future by offsetting its emission in Africa, further transferring the burden of curbing climate change to those people who had little role in causing it. Furthermore, we are concerned that the United States, by insisting on remaining outside the Kyoto Protocol, has become a for other developed countries to seek to evade rather than implement their legal binding obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. This undermines the only international agreement that establishes binding international emissions targets for developed countries. These positions are unjust as they are unsustainable. We call on the United States and other developed countries to recognize their historic responsibilities for the causes and adverse consequences of climate change and to repay their climate debts to Africa and other developing countries. Allowing temperatures to rise by up to 2 degrees globally and thus to 3 degrees in Africa is a death sentence to literally millions of Africans. We fear for our mothers and fathers, our sisters and brothers, your uncles and aunts and cousins. Your policy on climate change threatens not only our families, but also your own. We implore you not to crush the dreams of our fathers. Yours sincerely, your brother, your uncles, your aunties and cousins from Africa.
You have been listening to a quick digest of sounds from the Copenhagen Climate Talks, a dialogue between the United States and Africa. Find a rich mix of reports as free MP3 downloads at climateradio.org. You'll find it isn't the result of the conference that counts, but the rich mix of voices and issues that converged on Copenhagen 1 December. Dig in deep. It's our common future at stake. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I